So I'll continue with this morning with the chapter of Havli Mashiach. The word Chiva really means a chain, a rope, to be tied up. It's also a reference to pains. Pains come from tightening of the person's bodily organs in a manner that bring him pain, like the birth pangs. But we know that the most joyous occasion for any mother is the birth of a baby. So that's preceded by pain. That's part of the procedure of biology. That the pain precedes the greatest joy. Similarly also, the darkest point of the night is just before the dawn. It's even called, you know what it's called in Hebrew? Alot HaShachar. Now, do any of you know what is the meaning of the word shachor?
It means dark.
Shachor is black. Darkness. Because the light of the stars and the moon have diminished, and the rays of the sun haven't yet started. But Avot HaShachar, that's the darkest point, is just before the dawn. Similarly also, Chavli Mashiach is the darkest points in the history of the people of Israel is before the dawn of the redemption, when there'll be a renewal. So, it is sometimes the most difficult test, and certainly the people of Israel has become the most difficult test because the Holocaust was the most terrible suffering ever brought upon the people of Israel. And we can see after the Holocaust, there was a rejuvenation. The Jewish nation was renewed in many ways, bit by bit. But all the time there's a zigzag situation, ups and downs. And what's happening in Europe these days is unbelievable. Zot Chukata Torah, the first phrase of next week's parsha, and it was the day before Parsha Chukat that in the year 1242 the anti-Semitic Christians gathered together before the age of printing 24,000 cartloads of manuscripts of the Talmud and others for him to burn them in public. This was one of the darkest dates following the Crusades, the aftermath of the Crusades. A terrible gezeira. And Moshe Chaim Lutzato says, why did it come about? You know, Moshe Chaim Lutzato was a great master of the ethics of Torah in his classical work called The Path of the Upright, Mesilat Yesharim, taught in Musa Sefer. Same time, he was also one of the greatest Kabbalists. And he says that it's connected with the coming week's Parsha, where there's a verse which says, "Start Rezot Chukat HaTorah." This is the Chok of the Torah that describes the law of the red heifer, which is a Chok. A Chok is accepting the Torah, even if we don't understand it, recognize it comes from the mind of God, which is above the mind of man, in fact the source of the mind of man. And of course the source is greater than the creature. Creature is a subject, an outflow of the Creator. So it's logical that one of the aspects of Torah is Chok. And then later in the parsha there's a pasuk, Zot Chukat HaTorah Kol HaShabbat Oel HaShabbat Oel Mashavat Yamin. It says this is the statute of the Torah: Adam Ki Amut Po'el, when a person dies in a tent. The sages say this is reference not to the normal physical death, but the ohel is a symbol of the tent of Torah. A person should surround himself with a tent like that of Avraham Avinu. The word ohel comes from the root to shine, would shine through the light of Torah. How can you reach that level? Only if you kill yourself for it. When you kill yourself, kill your own self-centeredness and recognize that we will reach, as it were, Tchiyat HaMetim, revival, an inner spiritual revival, each one of us, if we attach our lifestyle to the spiritual lifestyle of the Torah. He said, because people don't dedicate themselves with heart and soul to the Torah, those who are able to, those who are given the background to be able to do so amongst the people of Israel, and instead we dedicate ourselves to just fulfillment of selfishness, pleasures of the self and power of the self, then we suppress the divine image in which man was created. So this is one of the lessons. And therefore, we might find it on the surface, we look at it from a natural point of view, that we have the state of Israel, where also according to the laws of the Torah, we've got to protect ourselves against enemies, and therefore we need to have people who would dedicate ourselves in a selfless manner to the economy and to the security of all of us. But we've got to recognize that we have to introduce into the world the higher concept of living, which will ultimately become the inheritance of all human beings. They'll stop fighting, and in a higher level of the human being will develop, who will not concern himself so much with the physical aspect of the human being, understanding it to be a means to an end, to develop the divine image, and therefore to make war and killings obsolete, and even to get to the level of Tchiyat HaMetim, which is where the spirit will overcome the powers of the body. So that's one aspect. So a person who witnessed this burning, you see, 800 years ago, almost, 1242, in Paris, he wrote a very famous lamentation, which is recited on Tisha B'Av. And one of the great traditional historians, he says there's another reason why it happened. And that is because a generation beforehand, there arose a big controversy amongst even the scholars and leaders of Jewry. And we know that when there are big controversies, which is a special type of hatred without cause, which can grow even amongst the learned if they're not careful to purify themselves, as we find also with what we read in last week's parsha of Korach, who was also very learned. Nevertheless, he was the source of such a huge split amongst the people of Israel. Especially leaders have to be aware of this. And the sages also say before the Mashiach comes, there'll be special tests to pass. How far will the Jewish people become unified? And what are the most responsible people? That means the leaders of the generation. What are they doing to produce unity and peace amongst our nation? And if they don't do enough, and introduce even the slightest aspect of self-centeredness, they say, I'm right and you're wrong, and create splits amongst the nation, it's dangerous. And this has happened in our generation. And I'll give you one example in which I was involved, personally. And the results of this controversy still exists today. And something which has to become known, it has to do with the Babicher Rebbe. So I had the great zechut to be close to him in my earlier years. And one of the questions I put to him, but even where I came from, my community, there were some Chassidim who said, the Rebbe is the Mashiach. I said, I don't believe it. Well, he said so. I said, I don't really believe it. So I had the opportunity, it's going back more than 50 years, or just a little bit more, 1963. So I asked the Rebbe many questions about other things. He's written on evolution. He was a great, fantastic genius. Not only an enormous genius in his knowledge of Torah, but also, in fact, as he told me, he studied science in 4 universities. He was up to date. Anyway, one of my questions was, is it true what they say? He said, on no account, I am not the Mashiach. And he proved it from different passages of the Gemara. So why do people say it? Because I fulfill the mitzvah, which also, you know, the Rambam counts it as a major principle of faith amongst the 13, that we have to wait for the Mashiach every day, and we should always look forward to his coming. It can be proved from many passages. In fact, what he was preaching constantly was also taught by the Chofetz Chaim in his last years, when he kept on saying, we've got to prepare for the Mashiach. He's waiting for us. And it was said by the Rabbi of Risk, who not any members of any Hasidic group, on the contrary. But there were misinterpreters of his words, and although those who knew the Rebbe well and were close to him, all anti-Mashiachistim, but some of them were Mashiachistim. Because, since the Rebbe kept on speaking about, you know, the Mashiach is due to come any time, which is the principle of faith, they said, well, the only one who can speak about that is someone who's the Mashiach himself. And he gives that there is a trend amongst many Hasidic groups to say that their Rebbe, some of them very close to the Rebbe, their Rebbe, and they believe their Rebbe is the potential Mashiach. No one else. That's why they cling to their Rebbe and don't like going to other Rebbes, many of them.
Can you cling to a Rebbe?
Sir, can I please?
Pastor?
Please, when I finish my paragraph, then have questions. So, this has its aftermath even today. And why did it? Partly, I think, is due to Christian influence. Because the Chabad Hasidim, by the inspiration of the Rebbe, have and continue to be the strongest movement of Teshuvah in our day, without a doubt. They are the ones who open to attract Jews in every manner possible to fulfill the mitzvot, and that is certainly the most important duty of all the Jews who know anything about Judaism to pass it on to those who don't. And they fulfill it with love and enthusiasm, the love of every Jew. And that's what's needed today. And unfortunately, this is still strong. And it's a remnant from the sin of the golden calf. Because it was the same thing. What was the sin of the golden calf? They said, "The Moshe Ish, this man, Moshe, he led us, he took us up from Egypt, he performed the miracles, and he's not back, not with us. 40 days is not with us. So surely he's not living anymore." And when he, even though he said, it was clear he would come back on 40 days, came a bit late, so they would have obviously not coming. So we have to have a means, a medium between ourselves and the invisible God. And that was even, they said, at their time, the medium was through the golden calf or whatever. So it continues to be the sin, one of the sins of today. Mashiachistim. And this has caused a split. Among the Hasidim, they try their best, those who are anti-Mashiachistim, to persuade the others. Not always successful. Because, just like I know, for some, I tell you stories about would-be proselytes. I know more than one instance where there was a person who was taught even by Rabbonim or Rebbetzins to prepare for Kedot. And in more than one instance, the people who taught them, and they learned very well, some of the frumest ones amongst the would-be Gaelim, when a question was asked, do they believe in Jesus? They said, of course. Every time I say a blessing, the Lord, who's the Lord? The Lord is Jesus. Sometimes they weren't asked. Even such situations where that's how the Jewish missionaries, not Jewish, but non-Jewish, who became Jews, from a very good bed then, they managed to slip through. And afterwards they went ahead, and they were leaders in the J for J movement. And there are others who managed to find out beforehand. And the same applies to many of the Mashiachistim. They haven't given up their belief. They just transferred it from Jesus to the Rebbe. And I saw it myself in many instances. The last time was I spoke to the Rebbe, so I spoke with him a few days before his stroke. He was a very close friend and gave the yeshiva and myself many blessings and many aspects of advice. But then he had a stroke, and I will not forget the last time I saw him when he was just a short time before he died. But they set him up on a platform with Ridam the Shechistim. He couldn't speak, and he was waving his hands a bit, facing everybody. And I'd already loved Mincha before, and I saw some davening Mincha. Most of those who watched him, they didn't take their eyes off him all through the Mincha prayer. Didn't look in the siddur. There's some of these Hasidim also. You know, they'll go and put a picture of the Rebbe in front of them. They're not supposed to daven in front of the picture of anybody. And I've been in a Chabad shul, and I see it in front. I say this is forbidden according to the dinim of the Baal HaTanya. Never mind, you don't want to follow the Shulchan Aruch. At least follow the Shulchan Aruch of the originator of Chabad, which says you're not allowed to. So we see this, and this machlok goes on till today. You know, there's some groups there who say, since the Serbian Shekisti must Chabad, we mustn't include them. You know, could exclude them from our newspapers and so on. And the Chabad say, some of the Chabad say the opposite. So this is one machloket, but there's a lot of other machloket which have come up in our time, even amongst the Talmidei Chachamim. So we have to work hard for unity in our time. And why did the 24 cartloads of in the year 1242 were burnt up in Paris on Erev Shabbat Chukat? It's even hinted at in the Parsha. It's because, that's what some say also, Chukat comes after Korach. But before the Mashiach comes, there are going to be tests. The spirit of Korach is still alive, of Machloket. Because there was a Machloket whether one could read some of the writings of the Rambam. Anyone who studied the Rambam today, we see his enormous wisdom. It's true that the works that he wrote in Arabic for the Jews, there were so many Jews in his time, became assimilated to the medieval Greek-based higher philosophy of the golden period of Spanish Jewry. They studied the sciences, and Jews made friends with many Muslim and Christian scientists as well. We know the Jews were on the whole amongst the best translators also from other languages. They knew, many of them knew Latin and Greek, way to translate into Arabic. As well known, the Rambam was a genius, 100 times or 1,000 times greater than I was mentioned in the Baba Shereba. It was very, very high level. And he mastered all the sciences and philosophies of his day, a great master of Torah. In his Mishneh Torah, he crystallizes the Talmud Bavli and Palmud Yishalmi in such a manner that the order of the Rambam is also significant. The way he put everything, the Talmud. Now, when you learn Gemara, it's a stream of debates, non-stop. Everything is debated, discussed. What is the source? And what arguments can you bring in one point of view and the other point of view? The halakha is worked out in a certain manner, and the Rambam crystallized it all. And he was also a great philosopher. The Mishneh Torah wrote in pure Hebrew. That was intended as a classical code. It's still until today to give us the basic, also the basic principles of faith and practice for the Jewish people, both in the Galut as well as in Yitzhak Shem, in the redemption. But in his works in Arabic, which written many of them even in Hebrew characteristics of the Arabic language, but that was a type of Yiddish, which is spoken later. Yiddish is German, written in Hebrew characteristics. Like you know in England, many of you have heard of the Star Chamber. The Star Chamber is the chamber of shtarot, of documents. Shtar is a document. Because many of the documents in the early period of Anglo-Saxon history, the Jews were known as scribes. And many of the Jews, they even went and wrote in English, but Hebrew characteristics. That was like an English Yiddish. And the Arabic of the Guide for the Perplexed and the commentary on the Mishnah is also written, I've seen some of the original texts of the Rambam in the Bodleian Museum in Oxford. It's written Hebrew characteristics, but in Arabic. Why did he write in Arabic? Because he wanted for the more assimilated Jews who could read Hebrew, but their spoken language was Arabic. And then it was easier. It was the art scroll of the Spanish period of study. Like today as well, many people, if you give them the Gemara, won't take them ages to learn it. Art scroll has introduced the ability for a person, and very much in favor of being used. It's the best way, if you're learning, especially if you're learning Hebrew at the same time, best way to master it. Want to go the long way, okay? Some people can do it, it's very difficult. Person just takes each word, insists on having the Gemara with Rashi script, although you can hardly read Rashi, and then it's word by word. It's a very long way of learning things, but it can be very thorough. It takes a long time. And these days, Hashem has revealed to us shortcuts. So that was the Rambam. And in those works, he spoke to them and explained things in a different manner. And that he did in the Mishneh Torah, because he was dealing with people whose knowledge of Torah and faith was very weak. Therefore, used arguments that would be accepted by them in his Mishneh Torah, which had to deal with how the Aristotelian or Neo-Aristotelian philosophy. So this aspect of the Moreh Nebuchim, Guide for the Perplex, which are known as the perplexity of the teacher, Nebuchat HaMoreh. Because people today, Aristotelian philosophy has become out of date. We live in the time of relativity, post-relativity philosophy, science. But some of the arguments can be applied today as well, in different ways. So, and a controversy arose. Some people say we're going to ban those books. Mustn't allow them to be read in any of the schools. Because if somebody reads it today, he'll get confused. They were right, because he intended it for people who were confused. Same applies. Therefore, they say the arguments became so strong between the pro-Maimonides and anti-Maimonides. They weren't really anti-Rambam, but the anti-Maimonides. Maimonides was actually the Greek and Latin terminology for the son of Maimon, the Guide for the Perplexed, and other treatises he wrote on Jewish thought, which he intended for a particular public, which also explains you'll find certain contradictions to what the Rambam Mishneh Torah and what he says here. But still, some were used for Kiruv. And today as well, There are arguments used for kiruv which themselves are not so valid according to the Torah, and they shouldn't really be put forward as being absolute truth. But like this, the codes, for example, the codes, if they come from the classical works on the codes by people who had deep esoteric knowledge, even, there's value to it. But if extended further by people in an arbitrary manner, it's not in accordance with Jewish tradition, and it can easily be abused, as it is often abused. Some people say, well, if we're going to make a Jew, he says, well, if there's such things in the Torah, it makes me feel good, and I'll start putting on tefillin because of that. Fine, so you should use arguments. Just like I've many instances where God managed to get people by giving the various arguments and statistics concerning the deep value, let's say, of the laws of purity in the family, which is given to every horse in the color. So I brought proofs from non-Jewish sources that this is a remarkable set of laws in the Torah that produce greater health. And we know the purpose is not just for greater, it's much, much deeper. But you can use those arguments. You can use arguments to get people to eat kosher for the fact that it brings greater health, which it has done in certain instances. But we know from the Chumash that the purpose is not health. It goes further. It's spiritual health. So, but you can use arguments to bring people to keep kosher. So what happened was, the argument became so strong that they went and burnt up the books of the Rambam. That was a period. Some people have come here to the yeshiva, I'll tell you this, and they've said, why have you got so much Breslov here between the yeshiva? You should ban it. You should burn it. Some people are anti-Breslov. So you're not allowed to. Or even Chabad literature. You can't go and just burn it up. It's so simple. I mean, there is a question, the extreme Mashiachistim, who goes stage further, and they describe the Rebbe in divine terms. I don't want to, I mean, if such things are published, that's real Avodah Zarah. Moment the person says the Rebbe is really Hashem himself, that's they've gone crackers, sugar. Not even sugar, they've got twisted ideas. From Christianity, the Christians say the same thing, yeah? Some of them. Not all of them, 10 churches don't think like that, but most of the sects, they think, the Trinity, they're all part, what do you even say? So, we go to that extent, it's already different. So therefore, why were the 24 cartloads burnt up? Because the generation before, they burnt up the books of the Rambam. So let's not have situations of burning up books. So this is a lesson for us. And why is it? I thought that this is all past history. Because, I mean, the Gezeira is still on for July the 4th. They're preparing for it, and there's no protest from, no ban put upon it, neither from the police nor from the parliament in England. It's unbelievable. I'm quite sure if there were extreme right-wing Jews who would say, well, like they even, unfortunately, they're right-wing Jews who say, well, if the Arabs come and they go and kill people in the middle of tefillah, the only way to give them a lesson is to do the same, which is not the right method, according to the Torah. But still some people are hotheads, and they say, well, let's go and attack a mosque. Yeah, well, that will create a conflagration, we know. And, the government here is right to ban this as a top crime, a terrible crime, if anybody threatens to burn up a mosque. Even though from mosque they preach death to the Jews. But if in London, if the Jewish group would respond by saying, well, if you're going to burn up Talmud, okay, and giving permission for such a demonstration to take place, then please give us permission to make a demonstration against the extreme murderers, the Muslims, who want to kill the Jews. And well, don't want to kill Jews, but with that they do in Paris. What we're going to do here, we'll burn up the Quran. It would create a worldwide terrible massacre, unfortunately. Yeah, just imagine. I'm quite sure that the Parliament of England, they were forbid it, and the police were forbid, they weren't allowed under any circumstances. Neither give them permission. It makes sense. Or if, let us say something else. If some who see the cruelties of Daesh and others, and these extreme Muslims, they'll say, well, if they're burning up the Talmud, yeah, if these extremists would say, no, we won't burn up the Talmud, we'll do something else. We're against the Christians as well, as they are. They're killing Christians all the time, Daesh and others. And they'll say, let's make a demonstration and burn up the New Testament. Parliament would allow it. Of course they wouldn't. So why do they allow this?
I'm not sure.
Huh?
I'm not so sure.
Huh? It's got to be banned. Appeal from here. Kol HaLashon. Anybody can hear it. Please. Especially those from Great Britain. What's happened to the sense of fairness, which is always considered one of the values of Great Britain? And if you think what Great Britain did in the last World War, we stood alone. So you can allow a burning of the Talmud. It's unbelievable. But this is the subject of this coming week's parsha. So really this part of the Chavli Mashiach. Now I say what's something else. The word Chavli Mashiach means the birth pangs, and it means the pain. But it also means a chain. It says in the Pasuk, Yisrael Hevel Nachalato. One of the phrases used in Tehillim concerning the definition of Israel. Israel, after all, means that God rules the world. And He's chosen the people of Israel to go and struggle to bring the rulership of God into the world. And Yisrael, the people of Israel, and also today we can see the state of Israel, is Hevel Nachalato. It's the chain of His heritage. Hashem has given a mission to the people of Israel that we, all of us, are like a chain. The strength of the chain is in its weakest link. Each Jew individually is part of the chain. Therefore, every Jew has got to cling to his fellow Jews, the other rings in the chain. The chain shouldn't be broken. So let's hope that all the troubles we have today will bring all of us Jews together, because when we have troubles around us, it's natural for people to want to work together. We have such enemies on every side. Let's all strengthen ourselves by holding ourselves together in one chain and recognize there are some weak links and some strong links from a spiritual angle. I mean, who regard ourselves and try to feel that we are part of the inheritance of Hashem for the future world. So therefore, let us express love to every Jew, recognize that every Jew must be brought to the power of Torah, and if we Jews will fill ourselves with the light of the Torah and the unity with all our fellow Jews, whoever has a good quality, he should strengthen it and help others to strengthen it. If he's got certain qualities in chesed, in doing loving kindness, let him help everybody. And not close up. He's, whatever he can give, whether it's money, whether it's physical effort, whether it's spiritual teaching to others, even more so. If that could be passed on. We have to prepare ourselves to be strong links in order that we will come after the Chevel Nachalato, the Chavli Mashiach, we'll actually have the Mashiach. Okay, now any questions or comments? Please. Yes.
What about, like, for example, I mean, what about the really extreme left-wing Jews? What do we do about them? I mean, they hate us. You know, they hate everything about us. They,
how do you know?
I mean, like...
I would say that today there's probably no left-wing Jew who, if we would work on him in the right manner that suits him, can't come from the left to the right, or to the middle, it seems better. Can't find to the middle path. The left Jews, I mean, there's so many left Jews who have become Baalei Teshuvah. I've in my life known hundreds of them, left-wing Jews, who changed, became believers in God, and started putting on tefillin, kept everything. We should not give up on anybody.
What about, like, George Soros? I mean, this guy spends...
Look, I'm convinced that if this, whatever he is, if he would be approached and a few people would work on him in the right way, he could change his approach. People can change him. He doesn't know. They don't. Most of those who are far from Torah, it's not their fault at all. You think what they've been through, can understand it. They can be brought back to Torah. When I was your age, when I first came to study in Israel, also at the time, together with another group of young rabbis who already had Mesmich. So, we had meetings with many of the heads of the different parties in Israel. There was an agnostic communist party led by a person called Moshe Sneh. And we discussed with him faith. He was a believer in communism. I told him, you've got a good name, Moshe. And also Moshe had his first revelation from the burning bush called the snare. Snare is a burning bush, a bush. So therefore, when we discuss things, I see that you believe in atheistic, totalitarian communism as though it was Torah Moshe. Yeah, that's what you believe. We had a friendly discussion about the truth of the Torah. And also the falsehood of atheism. I mean, as I've had the ability in previous years in college and other places just to work in universities in England before I came here, and I worked with many students who were agnostics, and I used to argue with them, and frequently they listened because I read up what's available, non-Jewish literature as well as Jewish literature, and there are many proofs for the existence of Hashem, as you have made a video on it as well. Who is God and how do you know he exists? I bring all these, God, look it up. So also wrote about it in my book. So I was able to argue with him. So what happened to him, and before he died, he asked his son to say Kaddish. I met his son. His son became a traditional Jew. And he himself recognized belief in Hashem. I think even last days wanted to fill in. But in any case, he recognized his mistakes. Moshe Sneh. The people, they're different. People in different experiences. And there's a person, very significant, in the first Gulf War, when we were going to sealed rooms, and they were sending scouts over different parts of Israel, and some of the scouts had non-conventional warheads, And it turned out in that war, the government here was under extreme right-wing President Shamir. But the Americans said, you can't participate in our attack on Iraq. That's our condition. We will destroy it. And we all, in those years, wasn't easy in the yeshiva. Every time when we heard the siren, and there was on the radio, it said, in which area is the next scud going to explode? We all had to run into sealed rooms, sealed number of rooms, completely sealed. We shouldn't be affected by the blasts. And it was known as the National Pacifier, called Nachman Shai. He was on the radio every time. Told everybody, wherever you are, if you're traveling somewhere, stop traveling, get out of your car, out of your bus, and lie flat, not to get killed by the Scots. And we know the Scots destroyed a lot of property. There's even a very famous photograph that came out of a huge house, mansion, in Savion. It's all in ruins, rubble, and underneath the face looks out. Because it didn't kill anybody. Nobody was killed from the Scots, which was a bit of a miracle. In any case, this pacifier, the Purim that followed, that Balfour, it was the end of the Iraq. Yeah. Saddam Hussein was in a pit. Yeah. He came out, and the Americans had conquered Iraq. So, that Purim was a fantastic miracle for all of us, because he could go free. So then I attended, for some reason, had a nephew also, was given an award by a certain group of the best mass media experts and promoters during the war. And Nachman Shai was asked to speak. So he said like this, I was raised in Hashem Etzi Kibbutz, where the name of God was never mentioned, where no one believed in God, and we're not allowed to, don't bring in religion. We're communists here. That was my Hashem Etzi Kibbutz. That's where I was raised. And I always thought, God doesn't exist. But now, I followed what happened in this Gulf War, and I see there's no other way explaining it that there were 39 Scots, and some of them very dangerous, and one of them hit the gasworks in Tel Aviv, which would have created a conflagration throughout Tel Aviv area. And at that time, there was some technical hitch and the gas was not going through the pipes. I said other things. They destroyed a great deal of houses and buildings, but not one person was killed. There is one old person who died from shock in certain situations, but not directly by the Scots. And so this, I see the hand of God. I can't deny it. I see that God looks after the people of Israel. Nachman Shai. They've got an example, extreme leftist went the other way. And it can happen with everyone, including Lapid. Yeah? I mean, I've got so much to see to the yeshiva, but if I could get hold of Lapid personally, Hashem has given me the people, other people, also the Quechem, I send other people. The person I'm trying to cultivate, I'll tell you a story about. Yair Lapid. Yair means he'll still bring light. He's got good points in him. There's a person called, second name is Cohen. He's a Cohen. He's a Sofer. He's an Avrich in the Koilum. He was crippled. He went into the army and became quite severely crippled. He was adopted because he went to a Machon Kosher as a cripple, and had to take special exercises. He became from, and then he went, even left the yeshiva in the koilu. The person who helped him was Yair Lapid, because they went to the same Machon Kosher. Until today, they go to the same Machon Kosher. And he has discussions with him. But who couldn't? Because Yair Lapid helped him. No, it doesn't mind. He helped him. He became a sofer. He doesn't mind. Because he feels he wants to help. Okay. If you understand the background to Yair Lapid, what's the background? His father is a Holocaust survivor himself. His father's ancestors were religious. Maybe Tommy Lapid, his father. Tommy Lapid was a brilliant speaker, and as a result of the Holocaust, to some extent, it weakened his faith. I'll tell you, the faith of a person going through the Holocaust was so severely tested that the majority lost their faith. It's a minority, some from religious background, some from non-religious background, who were able to survive religiously. Anyone who survived the Holocaust religiously is one of the greatest tzaddikim of our time. Because for Yisro Meshuggah, it says in the Tehillim, you'll become insane from what happened in the Holocaust. The vast majority of Jews have survived as zombies. And they lost everything. Some of them who managed to be saved by some of the spiritual giants, they helped to get back on their feet. But those who didn't, you can't blame them. If they didn't, it's but honest after what they went through. I mean, some of them thought there's one person, he wrote an account of it, from Warsaw, was the only survivor of the Warsaw Ghetto. It was in the last attacks on the Warsaw Ghetto. They searched the sewage in every single place. There was one person who managed to survive in the sewage, in the lower part, he describes it in the later account. Most of the people who went through the Holocaust could not speak about it for a few decades. It's too difficult. The only way they could live in this world was, as it were, to suppress it to the deepest aspects of the subconscious mind. It shouldn't come up in the conscious mind. It gave them enough in dreams. It created traumas. It created lunacy. How can you live in such a world? So, those who survived, it's fantastic faith. So I'll tell you one thing, one aspect of goodness in Tommy Lapid. Tommy Lapid, so he got involved in politics, a good speaker, a bit of a demagogue. So he saw more in a, he felt, how can he fulfill himself? He couldn't, for him it was impossible to get back faith. Couldn't do it. It's not his fault. You've got to treat them a different way. But he became a very strong anti-missionary. Because he knew what the missionaries, how many of the, even the missionaries came into Auschwitz and other camps. They said, we've got a way, we've got your passports here, anyone who's willing to become baptized, you just have to become baptized. Come with us, I'll take you somewhere else. That got him. Because Christianity has a stream within it which is one of the sources also of the Nazi movement, as well known, well known about the Pope. It's covered over, but there's a lot of anti-Semitism. So, irrational. Because they think, well, the Jews think they're the people of God, and they're not. We've got to show them that they're not. So this Jew thought there's no other Jews left in the world. And that's what got him to survive. He lived on sewage for food. It's a terrible situation that's good for almost a year, because he said to himself all the time, I'm the only Jew in the world. There are going to be no other Jews. So how would the Jewish people continue? I'm not allowing that to happen. And that spirit got into him so strong that he was able to survive. So these are the, each individual Jew could do a lot, and even the most left-wing Jew, or the most left-wing politics doesn't mean anything. There are plenty of left-wing Jews. I know left-wing Jews who are very religious. They just don't believe in the... Some of them are left-wing because they think the Israeli government is going too much in the ways of nationalism. And then they're neglecting the essence of the Jewish people is the religion. Without the religion, we're nothing. And there are elements in the government who say, no, no, the important thing is to say things which will provoke the nations of the world, because we've got to show them where they're wrong. And can't blame them from their angle. We've got to be shown there's a certain balance we have to preserve. Certainly some of the right-wingers have gone too far. Shall I tell you who became who was the strongest right-wing power in Israel? Who was it?
America.
For many decades. The strongest, since the beginning of the state, until he became prime minister, he was the most strongest power right-wing. I knew him personally. I spoke to him a good few times.
Begin? Menachem Begin?
Huh? No.
Shamir?
Yeah.
Yitzhak Shamir?
No, not Yitzhak Shamir.
No,
no.
It was Kahana.
No,
Kahana was not prime minister. He was banned.
Okay. To who? Don't know who?
Yitzhak.
Huh?
No. He was a prime minister.
What do you mean by Purim? Then Purim shot at the...
Ship.
Left-wing or right-wing?
Left-wing. Who was the most right-wing power in Israel until he became prime minister?
It's
Ariel Sharon.
Then he switched. He switched, became left-wing, extreme left-wing. Yeah? Well, so left-wing, I mean, which everyone today recognizes, it was a terrible mistake. It's also a mistake because Israel, what's the hope? If we look at it from a Torah angle, and we think, go and read Mark Twain on what Israel was like 150 years ago. He traveled north and south. He said, there's no growth there. The whole land was like a desert. There were only a few little areas where there was anything growing, cultivated. Yeah, more by Muslims than by Jews. Jews also cultivated bits here and there. And what's happened? When the Jews came, it became a most fertile land. And one of the most fertile spots was Gush Katif. Yeah? That became a beautiful area by the coast, cultivated. And the idea of giving it back was in order to give land for peace. And the idea was also that this land should be used to be cultivated by the Muslims in order they would have employment and they would also have economic benefit as a result, and poverty would disappear from the Palestinians. But there were actually two things. First of all, the terrorists took it over and used it as shooting ground to Israel. And secondly, even those amongst them who did try to follow agriculture and economy, and they were even given a lot of money also by Jews to go and build it up, so it should be the source of Palestinian economy. But the land didn't grow. Even the greenhouses would not grow so well for the Muslims as it did for the Jews. It says that in the Chumash. It's written, it says explicitly, the land responds to the Jewish people. And that's why, even now, what's going on in the West Bank, you know, there's so many Palestinians who are employed in the West Bank. And now the extreme left group, today it's Meretz, they want to put a boycott and join BDS and make a boycott on all products that come from the West Bank. But who's going to be the losers? The biggest losers, not just the Jews. But if they make a boycott there, then the West Bank Jewish settlement will no longer be able to employ the few thousand Palestinian workers who come over to go and work in their greenhouses, in their farms. So who's going to suffer? The Palestinians. I mean, this element in Meretz, you have to have a band of people to go and work on them and say, what are you doing? Your fifth column. You're destroying not just the Jewish people, you're doing harm to the Palestinians. If you want to work out some sort of a settlement with the Palestinians, they have to recognize the Jewish state. That's the demand made by Benjamin Netanyahu. And it's a sentiment, you recognize us, we recognize you. But if you're not going to recognize the Jewish state, in other words, your aim is not just to go to 1967, to go back and take over the whole country. Because the majority will become Muslims. And if you behave yourselves, we allow you to have a little ghetto here in this land. It's ours. Jerusalem is ours.
But they can't behave.
Pardon?
It's not in their nature to behave.
Yeah. Anyway, it depends on us. What I'm saying, each person, develop your maxima here in the yeshiva. Both do loving kindness, both in the yeshiva and outside the yeshiva, and also learn as much Torah as possible, and find the answers to questions as much as possible. Because we're going to have, I'm trying to work out now, the Shabbos in a week, we'll make a kiruv of Shabbos in the old city, and there we have questioners, and perhaps we can work something out to have a group of students there to spread the word of Torah amongst those who are outdated. A motto of mine is as follows: when you come into Israel, atadati or not dati? No, so I say ein yehudi shelo dati. That's shadai lo dati. There's no such thing as a non-religious Jew. He's not yet religious. He's not yet religious because he hasn't really met the saints. Yeah? He hasn't really also got deeply into the inner study of Torah. He just sees it from the outside. That's it. So we've got to try and get them all to get to the inner aspect of the Jewish people, which is, as we often explain, which is the blue and flag, the blue and white flag, the real blue, and Dril Magen David, which is the menorah, and we've got to make these symbols into actuality.
Well, Rabbi, what if that left-wing Jew, kills other Jews or active people? Like Soros, for example, sold out Jews during the Holocaust. They killed other Jews. I mean, what do we do then? I mean, they have Jewish blood.
There's a law that we have to protect ourselves against would-be murderers. That applies today to the individual or to groups. If they say we want to kill you, then Hashkem Barago, kill them first. Wound them, disarm them. They should be able to do it. Then we have to bring such Jews to the cities of refuge. Yeah, Rotea, even further, kill somebody else.